IQ, your weekly dose of inspiration. I am your host, Ikwabi Essien, writer, filmmaker, and entrepreneur, creator of Crowdfund Your Dream. I am bringing you tons of creative inspiration, everything from film to music, writing, dance, fashion, culture, and the arts. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. This is episode 3 of the Creative IQ podcast. I really wanted to come to you live and direct because today, November 19th, is Women's Entrepreneurship Day. So today I'm going to be attending iFund Women's Entrepreneur of the Year celebration, where they're going to be giving away $100,000 to one of the women entrepreneurs who is raising money through their platform. They had a whole pitch competition, different categories, etc. I'm super excited about that. And so in honor of Women's Entrepreneurship Day, I am giving you a podcast on how I launched my work from anywhere business. And before I start, I want to shout out a few other women entrepreneurs that you can check out. Recently, I held a crowdfunding campaign clinic for women entrepreneurs whose campaigns are currently live right now on iFund Women's platform. It was super great to get a chance to meet them and to talk more about what they're doing and to try to share some tips to help their campaigns go better. Let me just make sure I'm straight here. So just wanted to shout out a few of them that you can check out right on the platform and support if you'd like to do something extra special for Women's Entrepreneurship Day. So the first person I want to shout out is Felicia, who has a company called My Ghani. She's the owner and designer. It's a lifestyle accessory brand through which she creates inspirational products like greeting cards, mugs, blankets, and accessories for women and girls of color. So her campaign actually just closed on the platform, but if you reach out to her, go to her IG and tell her you want to donate, she might open up that campaign again. You can actually extend the end of your campaign, or she'll probably send you a link to PayPal or Venmo so you can donate. But you can also visit myghani.com to buy some of her wares. That's myghani.com, myghani.com. Go ahead and support Felicia. The next person I want to shout out is Naomi, who has a business called Your Precious Love. She happens to be a resource specialist working on the pediatric oncology department. And she started this business to help parents aid their children's physical, cognitive, linguistic, social, and emotional development. So through her line, Your Precious Love, she creates apparel, and she also is running a campaign currently on iFund Women for a playhouse called My Precious House. It's a children's playhouse that invites creativity and open-ended play while promoting gross and fine motor skills. Her campaign is in full swing. I went to check out the page. She's already started implementing a lot of the tips that I gave her during the crowdfunding campaign clinic. I think you're going to want to support her. She's got a really, really big heart. So visit yourpreciouslove.com. That's Your Precious Love, all lowercase, yourpreciouslove.com, and support Naomi. And that's spelled N-A-H-O-M-I-E, okay? And the last of the three I want to highlight that you should support today, in addition to myself, of course, you can buy my courses and feel free to send me cash too, I'll take it, is Lauren, who is the founder of Noted, that's N-O-T-E-D-D, which is a digital media platform for Black women, bringing them to the forefront of mainstream media through thoughtfully curated content and community experiences. So go ahead and visit noted.com, that's N-O-T-E-D-D.com, and you can also find Noted on iFund Women and contribute directly to the amazing work that Lauren is doing. So shout outs to Felicia, to Naomi, and Lauren, who are all in my crowdfunding campaign clinic. They are three Black women who are getting it done. I like to say to myself, that I could create a podcast called Nobody Cares About Black Women and just talk about everything that I do every day. Because as a black woman, as an entrepreneur, every day I feel like no one cares. And I don't want to say nobody cares anywhere. But I feel like our needs and what the type of resources we need to support the work that we do, it's hard to find. It feels like being on the low end of the totem pole in terms of the resources you need to create your business, to sustain your business, to connect with potential clients and customers, even those clients and customers, all well-meaning, wanting to pay you what you're worth. I feel that there is some historical, and I know it's a historical legacy of slavery and colonialism, right? In which black women's labor is expected to be free, free or low cost. And I find that most people, tons of people walk around saying a lot of like support BLM, support black women. But when the rubber meets the road, if you've never paid a black woman full price for any of her services, you're not about it, okay? So support a black woman entrepreneur today. Visit mygani.com, visit yourpreciouslove.com, visit notedwith2ds.com, support Felicia, Naomi, and Lauren, and you can also visit www.crowdfunddream.com, and you can purchase my courses and support me as well, or hit me up. You can go to my paypal.me and send me cash today if you want to support a black woman entrepreneur and do something right on Women's Entrepreneurship Day. So now let me get right into it. I have a ton of notes because I need to try to remember my own life. So today I'm sharing with you how I launched my Work From Anywhere business. It's gonna sound a lot fluffier than it did during the time that I was actually doing all of this. I heard someone refer to this as narrative fallacy, meaning that we sort of bumble through our lives and then we turn around and we create and we stitch up a narrative to make sense of what was often sort of in the moment, just making the best choices we could. That is how I would define the process of starting my Work From Anywhere business. Is I was just finding a way to become a freer version of myself. I always felt, from the time I was 16, I remember feeling like my managers didn't know anything, didn't know as much as me, weren't as innovative, couldn't problem solve, couldn't communicate, couldn't delegate from the time I was 16. Now, yes, granted, I was always top of my class. So oftentimes when I would get my first like entry-level jobs when I was a kid, I was always thinking of new things, new ideas, right? I was heading off to Stanford for college. From Stanford, I was moving to Manhattan and getting my first job. From that, I was going to NYU Film School, starting to make films, thinking about myself as a creative person, thinking of myself as an entrepreneur, because as a filmmaker, you're essentially an entrepreneur. Every film you make is a new business that you're starting, right? You've got to like come up with the idea, figure out who the target audience is, how you're gonna market it. You gotta gather your crew together. You've gotta audition people who are gonna be in the cast. Then you've gotta shoot the thing, right? After you shoot it, you've gotta edit it. After you edit it, you've gotta get the word out. You've gotta market it. You've gotta screen it places. You have to go do interviews and publicity. So really from the time I was a kid, I started learning those skills because my parents, my mom, may she rest in peace, mostly, started an African dance troupe from our basement called the Center for African Fashion and Cultural Awareness, through which we traveled around performing traditional African dance, drumming, fashion. We would even do events where we would share food. I remember bringing like food to my Girl Scout troop, like akara and stuff like that, and just sharing about our culture. And my parents taught us that we didn't have a lot of money, right? But they made up for that with love and a focus on education and really striving, you know, for a better future. And they taught us that if there was something that they couldn't offer us financially, we should save up our money and buy it ourselves. And so we got paid as employees through CAFCA. So my parents had us start bank accounts when we were really young. I still have the same bank account that my parents started for me when I was 10 years old. I still have that. That's my only bank account still. And just saving money and being able to delay that gratification for things that I really needed. I remember my mom being so shocked when I think my contribution for freshman year at Stanford, the student contribution for my tuition was $1,500. My mother was shocked. Like, we got the letter in the mail about what the tuition fees were and what my portion was, and I literally showed up with a check for my mom for $1,500, and she looked at me and was so shocked that she thought I had no money. I said, but I saved all the money that I've been making. I just save it. I started from CAFCA. I think my first job was at a deli, a local deli called Place Delicatessen. If any of my old Colony and Albany heads are on this, you might remember Place, because they were able to hire you before you were 16, I think. It was like under the table. But that was my first job. And then I was, I think, a file clerk when I was in high school. I worked when I was at Stanford. I had a job on campus. So I've always worked. And in all of those circumstances, I often felt like the people managing me didn't know much more than I did. And I always, because I saw what my mom was doing from a really young age and managing this business and paying, you know, us even as kids and teaching us that responsibility and having to negotiate contracts for all of the school assemblies and events that we did, get those contracts signed, get the money to, like, receive the money on time, pay us all out, you know, go to Nigeria, purchase the, like, traditional instruments that we needed to do our performances and get the costumes made and ship everything back over to the U.S. I saw that it was all very possible. I like to think of every African and certainly every Nigerian I've ever met as an entrepreneur. I think we're born entrepreneurs. I don't think we necessarily use that term. Because I think that term has in certain ways been commodified and co-opted by the power structures that be to exclude people like me and my mom and people that have been running business, traders, people who work in informal economy. I think of all of these people as folks that are creating their own future, right? So from those early lessons, I'm trying to jump forward because I'm going to talk a lot and I don't want this to be too long. Outside of school, once I graduated, so I was a pre-med back then, actually, because while I did tons of performing arts, I was really advanced in math and science, always was. I was taking college courses when I was still in high school. I was taking college courses at SUNY Albany. I came in as a pre-med bio major, and I wanted to change that degree because I found I wasn't that happy, and I felt that my greatest gifts to give the world were not going to be in the realm of science. I did not want to be a researcher or a doctor, and I remember complaining to my parents and wanting to change, and they convinced me that I shouldn't. I think I gave parts of this story in my intro to this podcast, so I'm not going to get too deep into it here. Long story short, my first job outside of college was at a global health communications firm, which I left after 9 months because I wasn't happy there. I applied for film school, but in the interim, I had begun parlaying my communications experience from that first global health communications job and the media experience I was starting to gather through my film background into a consulting career. And at the time, I did not think of it as like a pathway to create a work from anywhere business. I really just thought of it as like, I need to survive. What can I do? Sorry, let me take a sip of this tea. How can I use my skills, pay my rent as I live in New York, and have some reasonable amount of flexibility so I can creatively figure out what direction I want to go with my life? So once I left the Corkery Group, which was the first global health communications job, like in the interim between that and starting film school, I'd actually created my first website. Back in those days, you could create a page on Google Pages, and I just listed my skills, and I called myself a communications professional and editor because I love to write, and my job was largely communications. And I told people I could edit their essays because I've been writing, I've been editing even my sister's like grad school essays and things like that. They've been sending them to me and I thought, oh, I could probably do this as a business. So I created that website partly to begin to articulate who I wanted to be, I called myself an editor before I really was one, but I was like, oh, I can just put up a website and say this is what I do. And then when I would encounter people who needed that kind of help, I would just send them to that Google Pages site. It was literally just a white page with black text. There was no picture on it. There was just an email address and a list of things that I could do. And people would contact me. Eventually, I started calling it SEN Editorial Consulting. So that was sort of what I called my business. And I would draft up contracts with these people and I would edit their work for them. And in addition to that, when I finally did get into film school and start, my producing instructor told us that we should start our film company while we're students in film school. So I went down to the county clerk's office and I created my personal film company, ADT Films, just filed all the paperwork like a DBA. And under that umbrella, I then was making films. But fast forward many years, it took me many years to get through the film program at NYU. During that time, I more or less continued to work. Like, I took leave off school at one point for 3 years and continued to work because I had gone completely broke. During that time, I was doing tons of that type of creative work, communications, marketing, and increasingly fundraising work for clients ranging from nonprofits, companies, independent artists, musicians, like filmmakers, whoever needed communications, marketing, and increasingly fundraising support. I was just working with them. And occasionally I would take W-2 like staff jobs when I just felt like I needed a breather from the hustler freelancer life. I wanted someone to pay my health benefits and the rest of it. But just to cut the story short and kind of fast forward to the real foundation of creating what I have today, fast forward to the year 2017. At that time, I was a contract in-house copy editor for Medscape. I've been doing a lot of my more creative work on my own for years, obviously. But an opportunity came up where I could have, like, it was full-time work and it was a good hourly rate. And I was like, oh, I can like stash some cash for right now. So I took this in-house copy editor role for Medscape. And because as you may know, and I say this in some of my writings, if you're working, if you're a creative person and you're trying to make a pathway towards a financial future, and the creative economy is really bad for us, you can take some of your skills. Maybe you're really good at books, at bookkeeping, and you sort of start an on-the-side bookkeeping business. And especially living in a place like New York, where tons of people have businesses and they're not really good at their paperwork and keeping tabs on things, you can be having this business. I tell people, use your high-value skills to create like a financial foundation so you can do your creative work. So for me, a lot of times, those high value skills were my editing skills, my marketing skills, right? Because I had the global health communications background and it actually represented global health clients, because I had the biology degree from Stanford, right? Because I'd conducted primary research and written papers, I was someone who could do medical copy editing. And medical copy editing and fields like technical writing pay a lot. They may not feel very, very creative if you're a creative person, but if you have that part of your brain that you can work with and you have a couple of skills that other people find marketable, because people might not hire you to hold a camera yet, or to take their portrait, or to paint a portrait for that matter yet, you may use some of those higher value skills so you can start amassing some kind of financial foundation that can help you pursue the creative work in the time when you're not doing that skill. So oftentimes I would take medical copy editing work. So during that year, 2017, for about 6-7 months, hold on, 8 months, 8 months of that year, I was working at Medscape every day. So that's like showing up at a desk, doing medical editing all day. Believe me, the first day I took it, because I really needed the money at the time. The first day I showed up, I cried. I was like, I felt like a failure creatively. I said, I was supposed to make my creative career take off by now, and it hasn't. By that time, I'd graduated with my MFA and been out of school for 2 years. I literally felt like a failure. But at the same time, I knew I had these high value skills that I could use. I could earn some cash and then maybe I could come up with a new plan. Literally that year, that 8 months, I saved $20,000. I saved $20,000. That's after I paid my rent and everything else. Just because I decided I was willing to show up every day and do that job, right? So I did that job. And I was actually willing to go on staff. It was one of those temp to perm positions. But in the course of that 8 months, management kind of shifted. I was really super close with my supervisor, but they had actually fired her. It was really bad. They were going through some sort of dramatic restructuring. I was like called into a room one day with a bunch of people who were actually on staff, and folks were weeping in there. I mean, it's like you see the boss open up a phone call to call someone who works remotely and fire them, and then the person starts weeping. And that experience really imprinted itself on me. I mean, first of all, once management changed, they were no longer open to bringing me from temp to perm. They basically rescinded their offer. But then from what I had seen in that type of corporate environment, which I realized I never really wanted to be in to start with, I was like, I gotta get out of here. So, but when they decided they were not going to transition me from temp to perm, they also didn't tell me this. I remember it was like I think it was something like a Monday when I reached out to the agency that had gotten me the position. And I was like, I've not received notice about my contract being renewed, because I was getting kind of monthly renewals of the contract in anticipation of it transitioning. And I was like, they haven't really gotten back to me on what's happening with this transition, but I also haven't heard about what's going to happen, like about the next renewal of the short-term contract. And it was at that moment when I reached out that I was told, oh, you're not being renewed. And it was literally that contract was ending on the Friday. That was a Monday. So it was that literal kind of environment. If you've been in corporate environments, you know, it's very cutthroat and they don't necessarily always treat you like a human being. So that experience really imprinted itself on me. For one, because I just felt like I wasn't treated like a human being. I had the woman who was job would have been to notify me passing by my desk, talking and smiling at me, and she had said nothing. She had said nothing. And had I not reached out to my agency, I wouldn't have known I wasn't being like gonna continue showing up the next day. But then I also was no longer gonna have any income. But because that position was through an agency and it was technically a W-2 in terms of like taxes, I qualified for unemployment. So when I immediately heard that I wasn't getting this contract renewed, I immediately after Friday went on unemployment. This was the end of 2017, like the beginning of December 2017. And at the time, okay. So at the time, I had been on unemployment before. I'm not telling you my whole story because I'm just not choosing to say all of it. But I had been terminated from a job earlier in my story. I had had a job as a communications and marketing director of an arts nonprofit. And a long story short, I'd been terminated from that opportunity. My boss then later tried to rehire me, but I was kind of like, this is crazy, no. And then I went on unemployment. And that was actually the catalyst for a lot of the creative work that I was doing, because it was during that period that I was invited to participate in a leadership summit in Nigeria, in Lagos. I went for that summit for 3 days and then I hung around and I began writing a memoir of my late mom. So it really catalyzed a lot. I knew, because of that early experience I'd had, I knew that unemployment is terrible because I had sisters who lived in the city, they would usually let me sleep on their couch for a minute if I needed to. So when I was on unemployment the first time, I was actually living with my sister in the Bronx. And so when the opportunity came to go to Nigeria, I just left. And I was gone for the better part. I was gone for 4 months the first time. And then I was gone for a month the next time, because I like came back to the States. And then I went back for another month to participate in a white writer's residency. But it really catalyzed my creativity a lot. I must sound crazy. You're like, unemployment catalyzed your creativity? But sort of like having the time and the space to kind of rethink where I was at in my life, because I'd had a full-time job, and I really wasn't happy in it. So in certain respects, I was actually grateful when I got fired, and I probably aided in my firing by like having a lackluster approach to the job. So based on that first experience, the second time when someone decided they weren't going to renew my contract, it was a shock, but I was like, I knew exactly what to do. I was like, I'm going to get on unemployment right away. And at that time, I learned about a program that they have through, I don't know if every state has it, but the New York State Department of Labor has a program called the Self-Employment Assistance Program, which if you start a business while you're unemployed, you're allowed to keep the income from the business that you start, and you're allowed to continue collecting unemployment. I was like, but there's tons of requirements for SEAP. SEAP is S-E-A-P. One of which is you have to check in with a business counselor, you have to take a bunch of business courses, you have to give them like progress reports on how things are going with the business that you're starting. So I would say, so that the lack of the contract renewal happened the beginning of December 2017. I went on unemployment and I was in the SEAP program thereafter for like that following year. And during that time, I did pick up a client through my business. And so I was getting paid for the work with the client. I was also getting the unemployment through the SEAP program. And boy, did that catalyze my learning and my creativity. I took tons of courses during that time. I wasn't so sure the type of business I was necessarily creating. I was taking lots of marketing courses, just in general, trying to create an online business. I wasn't exactly sure what I would offer, but I knew I could offer communications and marketing and fundraising and help people like set up campaigns and things like that, create graphics, do video work if they need to, because I had the video, the film background. So I'd begun revamping my website. So formerly I had always created my own websites and I'd continued to do that. So by then, from that initial Google Pages site I had had years before, I had purchased a domain, equama.com, myname.com, where I was featuring like my film work. I'd also created a website for my film company, DT Films, that I was featuring my film stuff. And gradually, equama.com was more about sort of like me and my totality, like creative stuff I like to do, and the business stuff that I do. And then DT Films was just film work. And I had started, I decided that I needed to revamp that presence. And this was kind of in tandem with the Medscape job, the end of that job and getting on unemployment and realizing I needed to really ramp up whatever online business I was going to make. I hired a web developer to help me redesign equama.com. So when you go to that site now and you look at it, there's kind of like a split screen, and on one side you can go to my portfolio, on the other side you can go to my business services. And to be able to start articulating what it is that I offer, what's my key value proposition, what are my prices, how do I reach people. Formerly that was more or less a pricing sheet, like if someone would reach out to me, I would send them a pricing sheet about what I do and the different rates. But finally I put everything out on the website, and I was like, this is going to be amazing. What happened with the website? Let me get into that a little bit later. Let's start here. So what ended up happening is I was in the SEAP program. I was revamping the website. I had a client, like a retainer client. I was helping that client launch a podcast and doing like, I was basically working as a marketing manager for them and their marketing agency. So I was a marketing manager at a marketing agency, helping the agency market itself and launch their podcast and come up with other creative ideas. I was highly sought after for the job. This was actually the owner of the marketing agency I had worked with on the other side of the table when I worked at an arts nonprofit, and their agency came in to rebrand the arts nonprofit. He had been really impressed with me and we had kept in touch, and he had basically courted me to this position. But what ended up happening, sadly, and this is a huge milestone in my work from anywhere pathway, we ended up parting ways over a simple invoice dispute. So I'd been asked to do work on my day off, And when I sent him the invoice for the work, he said, I do not want to pay for that. Those were his exact words. I will never forget those words. This is part of what I say is the tax of being an entrepreneur in a Black female body. Have you ever had an experience of someone sending someone an invoice and they're like, I do not want to pay for that? Those were the words he used. And I was like, but you asked me to do the work on my day off. He responded something about, but you should want to just do that work to show pride in your work product. It's like, pride in my work product. This is work on my day off. So I insisted on being paid. He paid me and then promptly terminated my contract. So again, I had another experience of a contract sort of being cut out from underneath me in what felt like a really shady way. And that was the final accelerant that I needed to get my work from anywhere online business together, because I was tired of feeling like I wasn't in control of my destiny. I was tired of feeling like I had these big clients, right, that essentially controlled my income, that I was reliant upon and beholden to, who were somewhat precarious in the way that they dealt with me, and really not valuing what I brought to the table enough to engage in true dialogue, like, and human to human connection. I mean, I couldn't at that point. I was so jarred by that experience. So my website had been revamped, it was up, right? But I was so jarred by that experience that I took a month off. Like, I had enough saved up. I took a month off. My sister was doing a conference in Dublin, Ireland. And I was like, I'm going to go see you in Dublin. Another sister also joined me. So two of us went to see her in Dublin. And then I decided it was just going to be my month, my Euro trip. So I went from Dublin to London. And then from London to Paris. And I caught up with friends. I relaxed. I ate good food. I saw the museums. I took my walks. I went to Versailles. I did all the things. I bought my London pass. That expensive London pass. Take you up to see the Shard and the rest of it. Get you onto London Bridge and all of that type of stuff. I just did the thing because I really needed to decompress from everything that was going on. And it was great because it just gave me some space to think about who I was and who I wanted to serve and be around. And at that moment, I really did commit to serving BIPOC folks, for lack of a better word. I know it's not a great word, but Black, Indigenous people of color. Because my soul just needed it at the time. And because I'm a Hmong, like, you know, I wanted to be able to serve people like me. And I oftentimes wasn't sure how racialized some of my experiences were. That would be the last thing I would often think about, was sort of like the racialized implications of how I was being engaged with and treated. As someone who had a first degree from Stanford, a second degree from NYU, like 15 years of experience, I could go on and on, like, you know, but the ways that I would be minimized and nickeled and dimed by clients was utterly confusing to me. It was not my portion. It was not my ministry. So I knew that I had to do something else. And the something else for me really became creating an online course business. Now, I didn't initially, when I came back from my trip, and by then it was August of 2018 when I came back, I did not initially know I was going to be creating an online course business. But in the several months of having Equama.com up and running and having all of these different products featured on it and having nobody click through and buy, I realized that people really need a well-packaged offer, and that offering a smattering of things wasn't helping people make a clear choice about what my value was and how I could help them. So I started thinking along the lines of, how could I package up an offer that I just sell to people, that they get into it? And first I started with the idea of just sort of like a marketing template. like a guide to how to market your product, good, business, or event. Like a timeline for when you want to release all your social media posts, do outreach to press, et cetera, and so forth. And so I packaged up this guide, and I noticed some people were clicking to like download a preview of it so they could check it out. And what's really funny is my web developer, when he started working with me, was saying so many flowery things. He was like, you know, we could do this and put this here for when you have your course and all. And I remember at the time when I was working with him from 2017 into early 2018 thinking, why the heck would I create a course? I don't want to. I was like, I'm not an infopreneur. Why the heck would I create a course? But gradually, and in all the time that I was doing that, some of the things I exposed myself to was Danielle Leslie's mode of thinking, where she's like, all you guys sitting up here, hamster on a wheel, creating your podcast, doing all these social posts, creating all these free webinars, nobody's buying your stuff. All you need to do is create one course that you can resell over and over and print money. It finally made sense to me, because I was actually like, oh, if I package this information up to a course, it's the equivalent of, rather than giving a man a few fish, it's teaching that man how to fish. So gradually, and I didn't do it immediately. So I came back in August. Everybody's like, this is now a very long story. When is this over? So I came back in August, and I started reapplying for jobs. You know how you sort of fall back on your old habits? I started reapplying, looking for opportunities, thinking I was going to get another client who's going to save me, right? I'm doing air quotes in case you're just listening. And it wasn't working out. I actually had one client. What happened? I applied for an opportunity with a client who asked me to do, you know, sometimes you apply for a job and they tell you to like do a sample piece of work for them to review. First of all, I almost never do that, but this client, potential client, offered to pay for that sample work. I remember doing that and then them taking a really long time to get back to me, like a disrespectfully long amount of time. And when they did, saying something like, oh, we went in another direction, I was like, this is for the birds. I'm not applying for anything. I was like, I'm not applying for any more jobs. I'm going to sit here. This thought I've had of creating an online course in communications, marketing, and fundraising, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to put this course together, and then I'm going to sell it. I literally said that to myself. Now get this. I took 4 months off, and I did it. So unlike Danielle Leslie, who teaches the minimum viable course model, where you basically don't create anything, you pre-sell an idea. So you would say, like, I'm going to teach a course on communications, marketing, and fundraising. You reach out to a few friends. You tell them what you're planning to do. You try to convince them of the offer of that thing and get them to pay you. And then once they do, you create it and you meet in sort of like a group setting, perhaps on Zoom. And you've essentially launched your course with no launch, right? No website, no course materials, no social ads, no nothing. And once you meet with that first group of people, essentially it's sort of like a test ground for what the course might be. You can then take the money you get from that experience, you can pour it back into your business, either in actually building out the course materials, purchasing ads to get more people to come join you on Zoom, whatever you do. People like Danielle Leslie, check out Selena Soo, S-O-O, they teach this. Hillary Rushford, I think, is getting into this a little bit more. Well, it's not so much, she doesn't teach so much about creating online courses as being a creative entrepreneur and launching your venture, but those were a few people that had popped up on my radar at that time. But I'm too techie for that, right? My first degree is in biology, and I was like, I have to sit down and create the course so I know what it is so I can offer it to people, because I even needed to conceive of it. So I literally sat down, I created a 115-page workbook. You might ask, how did I know what to put in it? It's all of the stuff I would do with a client in a workbook. At 15 plus years of experience, I understand, and in creating my own, you know, freelance businesses, I understood from soup to nuts how to shepherd a project. If you want to raise money for it, fine. But essentially through inception, through completion, all of the different phases, business setup, bank account, like if it's a fundraiser, yes, you need a business structure, you need a business bank account so you can receive the money. What is your key value proposition? What are your key messages? How are you going to communicate them? You know, creating your website. I put all of that into the course, the 115-page workbook. I created bonus materials. a marketing plan and timeline, an email list builder kit, an email, direct mail, and social media outreach kit, and a graphics and promo video creation guide. And I packaged the whole thing up, right? And then I built a website myself because I'd always done it myself. So I built like a minimum viable website that just said what the course was and who I was. And I started selling it. But what happened, obviously this is what happens, is because I spent 4 months paying my rent in New York and not working and simply building my course, by the time February rolled around, so we're talking October, November, December, and January were the 4 months, so October of 2018 through January of 2019. By February 2019, I had 1 month's rent left. I hadn't really wholeheartedly started marketing the course, so I needed a client so I could bring cash so I'd have money to market the course, right? So I took on a retainer client in February 2019. And I kept telling myself, and I tell myself this every time. All the notes I took, and I'm not using any of them. I tell myself this every time. Every time I take on a retainer client, I say, this is my last client. Like the business, the scalable business is gonna take off after this client. This is my last one. So I took on a client February 2019, an absolutely wonderful client that helps socially conscious businesses, because at this point in my career as well, I can only work for people whose mission aligns with mine. I ended up being in that job over a year, like about a year and a half. It was part-time. I typically will only take on a retainer client for part-time hours at a reasonable rate so I can pay all my expenses and have time to develop my creative work and my own personal business. And essentially at that point, I had a work from anywhere business. I'm a 1099 contractor. I take my money and I do with it what I will. I only went into my client's office once a week. So everything else was on my laptop. So that was it. I was basically there. It's actually not that complicated to start a work from anywhere business, especially now in the pandemic. It's just figuring out what's your key value proposition. How are you going to share that message with people? How are you going to close, right? Either contracts with clients or sales, if it's a product, good, or service. And then how do you scale it and grow so that's sustainable for you? So, but I'm going to keep the story going because it gets juicier. So I was with that client for a year and a half. And the problem that happens for me when I take on retainer clients is that they take over my mind, they take over my psyche, they take over my attention so that I'm not focused as much on growing my own personal business, what I see as my online course business, right? So that's what was happening, right? And even within that, my online, my work from anywhere business has multiple streams. So I have the online course, which is self-guided, but then I have tiers to that course, which are mastermind and power coaching, in which you would engage with me one-on-one. The primary level, you don't. You just watch video modules and you complete exercises. And then on the side of that, I had one-on-one consulting in which I guide other artists, entrepreneurs, small business owners, and nonprofit professionals through communications, marketing, and funding their work. So I meet sort of like a coach twice a month. They give me a set of goals that they want to achieve, and I help guide them towards getting there. So at certain points during that year in 2019, I was like so stressed because I was trying to market my course business through free webinars, live workshops, and the rest of it. I was working 20 hours a week for my client, and then I was taking on one-on-one consulting clients. And I was just so busy that I wasn't really focusing on the online course business as much as I could have been in the early years, as I like to say, so that I could scale it faster. Because they're really a great way of scaling a, you can't replicate yourself. So I love that people want to do coaching, and I urge people to do coaching if that's what suits you. More and more, I would say member coaching, like in terms of group coaching, where you're serving a lot of people at once. So you don't have to feel like you're replicating yourself. It's just hard to scale. So an online course business is really easy to scale because it's a digital product. There's no limit to how many times I can sell it. I can price it whatever I want. As long as I convey value, people buy it. Now along the way in that journey and me being overstressed and trying to still figure out how best to scale my business, there's certain things I had to do that better. One of which was create an intro course, because sometimes people people who don't know you yet aren't as willing to pay for a high ticket offer. So oftentimes you have to create some type of low ticket offer that gets them in the door. Lots of people do free offers, right, to try to get people in the door. My experience with my personal business is you might attract a lot of freebie seekers who never convert to paying customers, but you have to walk your own path, right? That may be something you want to do, but you know, when I revamped my business in late 2020, like my story continues, right? I revamped my website. I hired a web developer for my new site, which is called crowdfunddream.com. Revamped the website, redesigned my course, created a series of tiny courses that were entry offers that then primed people for my higher ticket course offer, and relaunched it, right? In December 2020, I relaunched everything. Sold a bunch of tiny courses, but I started to realize that my tiny course offers weren't as well aligned with my high ticket offer. And in 2021, I actually had to redesign a new tiny course offer, which I've done, and I've sold a ton of those as well. So figuring out what they call your funnel to get people to you, to understand who you are, raise their awareness, like something has to trigger their awareness of who you are. Then they become, I'm describing here now the consumer journey. Then they become familiar with you through you telling your story, explaining what it is that you offer, what their pain points are, and how your solution solves them. Then the next phase is consideration, where they look at what your offer is and see if it's something that they want to purchase, right? Which is the next phase of this journey, purchase. And the final phase is loyalty, when they come back. They're like repeat buyers, and they're like in your community, and they're around, and they're excited about everything that you do. It's a constantly evolving thing, and I would say what really catalyzed the development of my online course business, which is my true work from anywhere business, the one that I really want to scale, my course, Crowdfund Your Dream, was this client actually letting me go. See, I never know when to go to the door. I need to be shown the door sometimes, but I think it's divine timing. So in the middle of the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests about the unjust killing of George Floyd, my client let me go. This is my client who does socially conscious business. And I have to admit, it also felt shady at that time when I was let go. I was being shown the door while my client was crafting a personal statement in support of Black Lives Matter and centering Black voices. And I had spent the majority of my time in that role as the marketing communications director, internally shepherding the company's rebranding, which was about to be rolled out. But I realized actually, and you have to always get your clients' buy-in, I realized after a time, and mostly as I was being shown the door, that my client was skittish about the rebranding. So all of the internal work we were doing in conjunction with an agency that was redesigning the website and the collateral and all of that, my client was totally skittish, and I was actually pulling him along. And the rubber met the road when it was time for the launch, and he was fully prepared to let me go and do some pared down version of what the launch should have been, take all the materials I'd created internally, turn them over to the design agency, and say, sayonara. It was shocking, but it was further evidence to me that I should have continued to pour in myself over that year and a half in my business, and maybe not have given as much as my attention towards that client. So long story short, I spent all of 2021 until today completely focused on growing my online course business. That's everything work from home or anywhere. I had some of my one-on-one consulting clients as well during this time, but even those I've pulled back on a little bit because I really want to figure out how to scale the online course business, because that's going to be true financial freedom for me. It's like sales in your sleep. That's the goal, sales in your sleep. So that's a little bit about how I did it. And while I do not offer a course on how to start your work from anywhere business, it's something that I do work one-on-one with my clients. Most of my clients are trying to do some version of that, and I just sort of share my experience, talk to them about business structure, about their strategy, key value proposition, their messages, marketing collateral, branding, like doing visual design and all of that type of stuff. Offers, how do you package up your offer, price it, who your audience is, like all of that. So what are their pain points? How do you solve them? How do you tell that story effectively on a website? All the stuff I've done for all my clients and for myself personally, I do help people do as well. So I've said so much in this video that I need to stop it now because it's going too long. But essentially, that's my the story of how I launched my Work From Anywhere business. It wasn't a straight line. Oftentimes, I made the choices I needed to make in the moment as a response to the situation I was experiencing in my life. And many times, from the first time when I was at the arts nonprofit and I was let go and went on unemployment to Medscape, when I was let go almost with no notice and went on unemployment again and was in the SEEP program, to my client who let me, I have too many of these stories. My client who terminated my contract because he didn't feel like paying my invoice, to my client who let me go during BLM, is that you have to live a life on your own terms. You have to create, sorry, there's a street sweeper going by. The beautiful thing about creating your own business, designing a website around it, and creating an offer is that you can articulate the value that you want to give to the world and the people you want to work with. Let's be honest, I don't want to work with everybody. I want to be able to articulate my offer to people who need me, right? And who value what I have to offer, right? So that is the joy of being able to create your own business for me. I know that there's people who have less tolerance for risk and they prefer to work for other people where you get a steady paycheck, someone else's name is on the bottom line, someone else is handling payroll and like the rest of it and hiring and like all of the rest of it. But I find that it's extremely rewarding to connect with people who value me, who need the expertise that I have to offer and who make me feel, quite frankly, like a human being. And in general, like all of the corporate, specifically the corporate experiences that I've had, even as a highly skilled person, they've often been really demoralizing. And so that's why my business, I say that I serve artists, entrepreneurs, small business owners, and nonprofit professionals. They're not always the people who can purchase all of the high ticket offers, but when you're able to convey the value that you have to offer, they will find the money to work with you. And you'll really help change lives. I feel like sometimes it's like a corporation doesn't need me, right? Corporations, especially large ones, often are very impervious to change. Some really great corporations spur innovation, are really looking for ideas from everywhere. But I've often felt largely like a cog in a wheel at most of the corporations that I've worked. And even in the smaller companies that I've worked, oftentimes I feel that I'm struggling to get buy-in from the higher-ups. And it's easier for me to have ideas and thoughts and change things as my own self working for myself because I'm able to innovate really quickly, create new products, create new marketing tools and strategies and just test them out and see what happens. I feel like as me myself, I have a greater tolerance for that and it's really rewarding in that way. So that's a little bit of how I started my Work From Anywhere business. I hope it's not too confusing. Essentially, just to sum it up, first degree in biology, next job, global health communications, next thing was film school, kept working, tons of freelance work, and gradually I just kept systematizing it, creating a website, creating an offer, refining that offer, connecting with people, selling it, you know, and occasionally taking on these retainer clients to help create the financial backing so I could continue developing my own business and do my creative work. Yeah, and my ultimate goal is just to be paid to talk, just to be paid for people to hear what's in my head, to not ever look at a sheet of paper, have to get my hands dirty, but just to be like, this is, you know, the body of work I've created. These are the results I've gotten for all my clients. Now you just pay me to talk. That's the goal. And then to invest the money and let the money earn for me and retire me because I don't want to be working forever. So this is the end of Creative IQ Podcast 3. All the notes that I thought I was going to need, I'm not using at all. Let's see if there's anything I want to add. No, in general, that's it. What I might do is do a follow-up podcast in which I talk about some of the stuff that's on, in these notes right here that I'm looking at. And that's in terms of giving you your own rubric for how you might start your own business. Because I taught this webinar earlier during the pandemic when everything got shut down and my friends were freaking out. I offered a webinar called How to Launch Your Virtual Business, in which I talked through the different platforms and tools I used to launch mine. And what I might do is I'll do a part two of the podcast, in which it's going to be very short, probably be 15, 20 minutes, in which I just talk through what those things were and help you understand it. It's weird because I think everybody knows this stuff already because it's so much in the mainstream. My whole news feed is just full of how to start your this and how to start your that. I think partly because my core offer is not that. I don't have a problem just talking about it. Like, some people would be like, I should package it up into a course and then sell it to you. But I'll just tell you the stuff that I need, that I use. What I really love, there is an entrepreneur I follow who, when you go to her website, she has a page that just says platforms I use and tells you everything she uses to do everything to organize her life and her business. I think I may create a page like that on my website as well in advance of this chat, because that might be helpful too. Yeah, that's about it. It's Women's Entrepreneurship Day. Pay a Black woman today. Listen, I've got my Octavia Butler mug, okay, the author. And I want you to pay a Black woman today, buy a book, buy a song, buy a t-shirt, send some money, donate to a campaign, do whatever you need to do. Like I said, I think I could call this podcast Nobody Cares About Black Women and just talk about my life, because that's what it feels like, and not expect anybody to listen but Black women and be completely contented with that. And don't get me started on the matters concerning African women. I'm African as well, Nigerian, so we have to save ourselves. We continue to save ourselves. We continue to make a way where there's no way. We continue to create institutions and resources that feed the earth, right? That people the earth, that allow communities and countries to thrive. So I'm doing my part. What's yours? Happy Women's Entrepreneurship Day, and I'll see you next time for part two.